This is Age of Treason Radio. With your host, Tan Stoffel. Race and Jews, Part 1. This is going to be a series about race and Jews. What is race? What are Jews? The two questions are connected to each other. To understand what Jews are, you have to understand race. And to understand everything else, you have to understand the Jews. The conventional wisdom amongst people who ask these kind of questions is usually divided between two extremes. They either argue that Jews are a race or that Jews aren't a race. I'm going to explain how I see it, and I think it's somewhere in between those two poles, although more toward Jews as a race, I'm going to argue, and provide evidence that Jews are a race, or at least a racial group. I don't think there's any dispute that they're a group, and the nature of that group is racial. And by racial, I mean heritage, having to do with heritage. And heritage is birthright. It's everything that's bequeathed by parents to their children, and it's everything inherited by children from their parents. It's both genes and memes, both biology, ideology, the culture, the language, and the arts, the traditions, the history, the legends, the myths are what I mean, broadly speaking, by memes or ideology. And most critically of all, in that is the consciousness or identity, the knowledge, the understanding of who you are, what group you belong to. Because the genes alone won't tell you that. They'll give you some basic instincts, some certain tendencies, and even the tendency to be able to identify other members of your group instinctively. But it really is only completed by the mimetic half that must be passed on as well in order for a group to continue to exist. What is identity? There was an article recently published in the Occidental Observer that had this snippet that I think is worth reiterating. It's quoting from William Graham Sumner, a 19th century anthropologist who was describing social identity theory, which is something that Kevin MacDonald talks about a lot. And Sumner wrote, "Loyalty to the group, sacrifice for it, hatred and contempt for outsiders, brotherhood within, warlikeness without, all grow together, common products of the same situation. It is sanctified by connection with religion. Men of an others group are outsiders with whose ancestors, the ancestors of the we group, waged war. Each group nourishes its own pride and vanity, boasts itself superior, exalts its own divinities, and looks with contempt on outsiders. Each group thinks its own folkways the only right ones, and it observes that other groups have other folkways. These excite its scorn." Now, the Jews who currently dominate mass media and education have defined such identity as hate, as something pathological, but only when it's exhibited by whites. Not when it's exhibited by Jews, not when it's exhibited by other non-whites. That's one clear distinction between Jews and whites, and a contradiction of any claim that Jews are white. is in how hate is defined, that this form of identity is a good litmus test, that Jews exhibit it, and the Jewish media does not accuse them of hate, does not pathologize them as haters, instead portrays them as healthy for having that kind of an attitude, whereas whites are treated to an opposite standard. Now, last year I did a long series focused on Jewish identity, and this is really another pass at the Jews, another attempt to work through some of the details, some of the both the gross and the subtle aspects of Jewish identity, and try to understand them, try to explain them, especially for listeners who haven't thought about these things, aren't aware of these things. You could start at the first episode in the series that I titled Jewish Crypsis, and that's how I began it. And it really, Crypsis captures one essential element, one really key feature of the Jews, and Crypsis is the idea that, of disguise and being secretive. And beyond that, the duality, that there are many aspects of the Jews that seem to reduce down to, or spring from, I should say, this two-facedness or two ways of seeing things, and including this issue of whether Jews are a race or not, and the bouncing back and forth that Jews themselves have done on that subject. Are they a race or a religion is one aspect of that. Are they weak and oppressed, or are they the most enduring group of people that ever in history? Are they adaptive, or are they inflexible? Now, sometimes they're called an ethnic group rather than a race. And that's really just another word for the same thing. Ethnicity is racial in nature and only implies a closer genetic relationship. It also has connotations of common religion, common language, common culture, meaning common myths, heroes, holidays, music, literature. And in this, in all of these aspects, the Jews really don't qualify any more as an ethnicity or an ethne than they do as a race, because their one subgroup, the Ashkenazi, is very closely genetically related, but they are divided by language. They're divided by culture, even, depending upon what host they live amongst, whether they live in Israel or outside of Israel. It's another big dividing line. So they don't really qualify technically as an ethnic group either. And the argument is pretty much the same. The debate between whether Jews are a race or not is similar to whether they're an ethnic group or not. Here's one of my main objections to thinking of the Jews as a race. It is the idea that they're somehow comparable or similar to other races or other ethnies, for that matter, that there is some symmetry or congruence between Jews and everybody else. And that's just not true. It's not the reality. The reality is their incomparability, their dissimilarity, the asymmetry and the incongruence between them and everyone else. Why do we do this? Why do we tend to want to see them as similar or as comparable in some way, even if it's simply by identifying them as a separate race and by calling them a race or an ethnic, putting them on par with other races and ethnies? Why do we do that? Well, that's a white or Aryan personality trait, a tendency in our personalities, I think, to project positively, to see others like ourselves, to want to see others like ourselves, to be objective and universal in our thinking, to think that the rules, once we identify them in ourselves, apply to across the board. it's a tendency, and you could see it in a negative sense too, as us being unsubtle intellectually, and even gullible. And it's just a tendency. As I've said before about character traits, racial character traits, is that they are simply tendencies. They're not black and white, between the races, distinguishing the races. It's relative to the Jews. When I call whites and Aryans, objective, it's relative to the Jews. They certainly are. And in this series, I'll provide examples and, other thinkers who have noticed this difference, noticed this contrast. One of the items I'd like to discuss here right at the start is racialists versus race realists. Sometimes the term race realist is used, and in its literal sense, there's nothing wrong with it. If you think that race is real and significant, then you're a race realist. But there is a certain connotation to that term, too. And let me read a bit from an article here before I get to that. The article is titled, "Are Jews Natural Race Realists?" That was published at Occam's Razor, a blog that focuses on race. The question whether Jews are natural race realists might seem odd to some, considering that Jews, since the 1950s, have been at the forefront of promoting the, quote, race is a social construct, unquote, myth. In fact, Jews today, following the lead of people like Franz Boas and Israel Ehrenberg, a.k.a. Ashley Montague, have almost single-handedly transformed the social sciences away from Darwinian models toward black slatist / race does not exist models. But things were not always this way. Prior to World War II, Jews, and by Jews I mean mostly Ashkenazis, were some of the most adamant race realists. Mitchell B. Hart's 2011 book by Brandeis University Press, Jews and Race, Writing on Identity and Difference, 1880 to 1940, shows that Jews, prior to World War II, overwhelmingly believed in the reality and importance of racial differences. Even Franz Boas, who later would promote the, quote, race is a social construct, unquote, myth, early on believed in the hardwired reality of racial differences. So what happened? In short, World War II happened, whereafter Jews decided race realism was bad for Jews and began to promote race denialism. Israel Ehrenberg, a.k.a. Ashley Montague, and others even muscled the United Nations into declaring that race isn't biologically real. But things aren't so simple. Although Jews today prescribe race denialism for the West, in Israel, they are the ultimate race realists and ethno-nationalists. It was a long time ago, several years ago, that I noticed that the people who identify themselves as race realists tend to be Jew blindists. They tend to ignore the fact that Jews are distinct from whites and, in fact, hostile to whites. In fact, the number one person who comes to mind when you say race realist is Jared Taylor, who has made that a signature of his tactics, that he says Jews look white to me. And now this is somebody who acknowledges that race is real, but then reduces it to just skin color, just like the anti-racists do. On another occasion, more recently, Jared Taylor described discussing race and Jews as two distinct ways of being a crank. At the same time, saying that, or implying that these things were somehow wrong by calling it crankery, and also being wrong in describing them as being different. So this is someone who's more of a race surrealist than a race realist. The irony of Jared Taylor's tactic of talking about race but accepting that the Jews are white pretending that the Jews are white, is that Jared Taylor himself is attacked by Jews as a racist, as a Nazi. And there's an article I'll link about, written by a Jew, that's titled America's Virulent Racists, The Sick Ideas and Perverted Science, in quotes, of the American Renaissance Foundation. Let me read just one paragraph from that article about, and this is by a Jew named Sussman writing about Jared Taylor and his organization. I would hope that most public venues would not allow a Nazi rally in their facilities. The history of the Pioneer Fund and the American Renaissance Foundation shows that there is little difference between the ideals and goals of these organizations and those of racial hate groups that have caused misery throughout the centuries. Modern science now undermines all of their basic premises, and there is no reason to tolerate their hateful, dangerous, ancient, and outdated assertions. If just one racially motivated hate crime is prevented by depriving attendees of the stimulus these conferences provide for some of its more radical and deranged followers, then we have ample reason to close them down. This is what I call the Jewish narrative, and you can see here the one of the hallmarks of the Jews and their narratives is the inversion of reality. Jews, without any apology or hesitation, blame quote-unquote racists, meaning broadly whites, for causing misery throughout the centuries. And in doing that, they're transferring the blame away from themselves for causing that misery. Another trait that we see here, a recurring theme, especially in the last 100 years, is cloaking their Jewish agenda in science, claiming that they have science behind them for what they're doing. And this is a fraud that they've been perpetrating for 100 years, and it's some of the first things that I'd like to discuss here in this series. Some examples of this. This fraud that Jews have perpetrated has cost the lives of millions of whites already and stands to cost millions more, and the ultimate extinction of whites as a race. Brooks Bain linked recently a segment or some snippets from a book titled The Price of Whiteness, written by a Jew, and published recently in 2006. This is a book by Eric Goldstein. Lots of fascinating stuff here about the Jewish mindset, the Jewish attitudes, about this racial identity, about themselves, and about whites. So it's worth digging into this book at length. I'm actually going to go quite a bit farther into it than Brooks Bain provided in the brief snippets, but including what he noticed about it. The summary of the book at Google Books, it goes like this. The Price of Whiteness documents the uneasy place Jews have held in America's racial culture since the late 19th century. The book traces Jews' often tumultuous encounter with race from the 1870s through World War II, when they became vested as part of America's white mainstream and abandoned the practice of describing themselves in racial terms. I think that's a fairer way of putting it, actually, than how Occam's Razor portrayed it. It's one of the, I think Occam pretty much got it right, but I think exaggerated the, or misinterpreted when the transition from accepting race and embracing race and rejecting it kicked in. It wasn't really World War II that triggered it. It was already in process before World War II, this transition away from race and a racial definition of themselves. It really was just noticeable to the rest of us in the wake of World War II. This book, it's one of the reasons why this book is interesting. is because it actually documents, from a Jewish point of view, this transition, why they adopted race to begin with, a racial language to describe themselves, and why they abandoned it ultimately. So in chapter one, starting right at the beginning, I'll start reading a bit here and commenting as we go. In 1887, Solomon Schindler, rabbi of Boston's Temple Israel, delivered a Friday evening sermon to his congregation on the topic, quote, "Why am I a Jew?" unquote. Schindler spoke of the universal task of Judaism, its superior logical foundation, and its concordance with reason in explaining why he was a follower of Jewish religious teachings. But first and foremost, he emphasized, his connection to Jewishness was a matter of race. Despite the fact that the Jewish nation had disappeared from the earth, remember this is 1887 before Israel had been refounded. Schindler told his congregants, quote, "It remains a fact that we spring from a different branch of humanity, that different blood flows in our veins, that our temperament, our tastes, our humor is different. In a word, we differ from non-Jews in our views and in our mode of thinking, in many cases as much as we differ in our features," unquote. I'll note here that this Jew has a more accurate view of the nature of Jews than Francis Parker Yockey expressed half a century or more later. Goldstein continues, "The use of race as a positive means for self-description among American Jews has not been well documented by historians, and given the contemporary implications of the term, most likely comes as quite a shock to the modern reader. Even more surprising is the fact that this self-description was employed by Schindler, one of the most radical exponents of 19th century Reform Judaism, a movement usually seen by scholars as having distanced itself from strong expressions of Jewish particularism in its attempt to adapt to the American setting." I'll interject here to point out that that's how religion figures into Jewishness, is the Orthodox Jews, the most religious Jews, are the Jewish Jews. They're the ones most concerned about racial purity, ironically enough. And it's the Jews further out, the conservative Jews and the Reform Jews, that make more and more accommodations, become more and more assimilated to the hosts in amongst whom they live. And that's what Goldstein's getting at here, is that Reform Jews are the last Jews that you would expect to be putting forth this idea of Jews as a race. But again, this was in 1887. Today, it's really only Orthodox Jews that will speak this frankly. And I don't think that they use the term race, but they use equivalent language that makes it fairly easy to equate to race. What Schindler's remark testifies to, however, is the pervasive use of racial language as a means for Jewish self-definition in the late 19th century America, even amongst those anxious to take their place in American life. This is one place where reading a Jew, you have to constantly read between the lines here, and you see the apologetics going on here, that the Jews weren't anxious to take their place in American life. They were anxious to live in America to exploit Americans. By race, 19th century Jews meant something different from ethnicity in its present usage. Their conception of Jewish distinctiveness was one rooted not in cultural particularity, but in biology, shared ancestry, and blood. Well, that is also implied by ethnicity, but I think what Goldstein is getting at is that even today, the word ethnicity has been drained of its genetic meaning. Goldstein continues, "Such overt racial discourse has usually been treated by modern Jewish historians as the province of anti-Semites. Yet racial language also served as an attractive form of self-expression for Jews. American Jews drew comfort from a racial self-definition because it gave them a sense of stability at a time when many familiar markers of Jewish identity were eroding. I'll inject here, this is another hallmark of the Jews complaining always that their situation is falling apart, that the Jews themselves are disappearing, that, or in this case, the language, that Jewish identity is eroding. They're constantly worried about it, that's true, and they're constantly complaining about it. But as I mentioned at the beginning, they're the longest or among the longest existent groups on the planet. So to hear them complain about it is part of the secret of how they maintain their integrity for so long. How they remain. How they continue their existence. Continuing. Despite its strong biological thrust, the racial definition of Jewishness did not impede Jews' identification with American society and institutions during these years, because non-Jews of the period generally saw the Jewish race as in a positive light and defined it as part of the white family of races. Jews had few reservations about defining their communal bonds in racial terms. Race then fit the needs of the Jews to define themselves in a changing social landscape, allowing for emotional security and a degree of communal assertiveness without threatening their standing in the larger white world. What Goldstein is getting at here is that 100 years ago, people understood race not in the terms that we understand it today. When you hear race discussed today, it implies to most people a very coarse black and white difference. In fact, race realists fall into that boat where when they talk about race, they literally see black, white, and yellow, and maybe red. That's the level of cartoonish contrast that they see, that their race realism is race surrealism is reduced to. 100 years ago, even white people understood whiteness as a composite of several different sub-races. And unfortunately, as we see from the consequences, the disastrous consequences, also considered the Jews part of that family of races. At the time, the Jews, we see, acknowledged that race existed. That's the point that Goldstein's making here. And they, beyond admitting that race exists, they admitted their own separate racial identity as a group. And I think that actually comes close to the reality. They did this because it was seen by Jews as good for the Jews to do that. That's why they did what they did. That's what the consensus was at the time. It fit the needs of the Jews in this larger white world. And this is another thing to remember always, always about the Jews and what they do, that to understand what the Jews are doing, you just have to understand their prime directive, the core of their morality. Is it good for the Jews or not? That's the question that they ask themselves about everything. It always comes down to whether it's good or not for the Jews. When it comes to race, admitting race was good for the Jews until it wasn't good for the Jews anymore. At some point, it could easily become good for the Jews again, and it probably will.